listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
I know I really loved both of the novels we'll be discussing tonight, and I think you're going to love them as well if you haven't read them already. Mona Simpson's casebook is told through the eyes of a young boy living on the west side of Los Angeles whose family is unraveling. Michelle Hunnevin's new novel is set during the Reagan recession years when a gifted PhD student in economics moves into her parents' Sierra vacation home to finish her PhD thesis and ends up enmeshed in the life of the residents of a small California mountain town. In both these novels, readers have an opportunity to contemplate erotic love, parental love, through a variety of lenses. Maybe love stories are all mysteries, Mona Simpson remarked in an interview, which also strikes me as applicable to both these beautiful works of art. What does a daughter's romantic love mean to her parents? What do parents' love lives mean to their children? What are the destructive forces unleashed by the rapture of new love? Both fictional characters, the boy hero Miles Adler Hart in Simpson's casebook and the wayward PhD student Cressida Hartley in Hunnevin's Off Course, will remain with you long after you've finished these novels. Michelle Hunnevin and Mona Simpson are both Angelenos. Michelle was born in Altadena, California, where she lives today. For many years, her day job was reviewing restaurants and writing about food for many periodicals, including Gourmet and the Los Angeles Times. She's the author of the much-lauded novels Round Rock, James Land, and Blame, and among her many awards are the GE Younger Writers Award and a Whiting Award for Fiction. Mona Simpson moved to Los Angeles as a young teenager. She published her first short stories while in graduate school at Columbia. She worked at the Paris Review for 5 years while writing her first novel, Anywhere But Here. She's also the author of The Last Father, A Regular Guy, Off Keck Road, and My Hollywood. And she's been awarded numerous prizes, including most recently a literature award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. In conversation with Mona and Michelle tonight is Christopher Bolas, a distinguished psychoanalyst and literary theorist who is also a novelist and playwright. His PhD in English literature at the University of Buffalo was on the work of Herman Melville. Among his books are Catch Them Before They Fall, The Psychoanalysis of Breakdown, and The Christopher Bolas Reader, with foreword by Adam Phillips. And I'll note tonight that while the conversation is on love from three perspectives, none of our guests professes to be an expert on the subject. They are all still learning, and that's probably one reason why their work is so invigorating. Please welcome Michelle Hunnevin, Mona Simpson, and Christopher Bolas. Thank you.
Well, lovely to be here. And we decided to pick love because it was such an easy topic. However, it's been displaced in the last half an hour by anxiety.
What's the difference?
That's a great question. Because if you are falling in love for a while, I would hope you're going to be anxious, right? And your character, Cress, she gets anxious.
She might even fall in love because she's so anxious to begin with that love gives her a place to create or to fill with her anxiety.
Mm. Yes, because when she's moving around about in the mountains, meaning we're not going to give the plots away, we've got to read these books, but the storyline, but she rather does sort of find people to love or to be in love at a very particular time in her life, mm-hmm. when she needs to be in love, perhaps. Mm. You agree?
Yeah, I agree. She's transitioning. She's an ABD, all but dissertation. She's finished her graduate school. She has to write this dissertation. She doesn't particularly want to write her dissertation. And so she starts to fall in love. And love is very organizing for a human.
And there are moments, there are great moments when she actually does relax with her lover, when she's at peace and everything slows down. She sees the beauty of where they are in the mountains, and it's breathtaking for the reader at the same time as it may be for her.
It's wonderful you say that it's organizing, because it really is, isn't it? I mean, or you feel.
It feels organizing. Is it really organizing?
It doesn't always go the way we think it's going to go, though, does it really? If we're talking about romantic love, which is, I suppose, what we are at this moment at least talking about, romantic love.
And whether it exists.
It seems to. We seem to
exactly
think it does.
So.
We at least go for it. You are addressing in your novel many other kinds of love as well, not just romantic love, but at least one aspect of a child's love of his mother, which is very moving and compelling. And it's not, in a sense, is it, by choice, because we're born into families and
sure
we have
are.
No idea that this, that we have no choice, do we? It's a long time before we realize we do have choice. Children don't know that.
And do we even ever really? I mean, our families are our families. We get what we get.
Yeah.
You know, we have what we got.
Well, then you marry and you make a choice for better or worse.
That too.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's where romantic love perhaps slightly enters the scene. But
hopefully.
Your character, your wonderful character, Miles, is, you tell us about him.
My character is a snoop. But he's a particular kind of snoop. He's driven, and yet he only discovers what he most doesn't want to know about his family and ultimately even about himself, I suppose you could say. There is a romantic love story in my book, too, but it's a little more embedded. Michelle's book is wonderfully head-on. It's exactly about the lovers and their experience. And in my story, it's a little bit more about the family watching this love take place. Mine is a middle-aged love, and so it's told from the point of view of a son, and we're kind of watching the kids figure out what love means to them, because they're also they're figuring it out first while watching their mother's romance, but they're also figuring out what they're going to want in their life, what they believe in, whether they think this love thing is a good idea or maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I suppose an aspect of it is that when we're children, love is between friends, isn't it? Girlfriends, boyfriends, those are very strong love relations.
Intense love can be between friends.
Yes. And you have...
Is that only as children? Not really.
No, but we're only children once. And during that particular period of time, there are special forms of love, aren't there? Like when I was, as a kid, I remember thinking, what are the girls whispering about?
Yes.
I never had much of anything to say to any of my buddies. You know, we'd say stuff to each other, but what the hell were they talking about? It would go on and on and on in such passionate ways. There are these little secrets of childhood that we abandon then when we get to become adults, whatever the hell that is.
Sometimes we abandon them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You want to share some of the secrets?
No, but I mean the kind of talking that women do, I think they do throughout their lives, and probably befuddle men the entire time.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah, you're getting a nod from...
I had a very unusual childhood. I had kind of what you'd almost call a immensely romantic relationship with my mother. I was kind of my mother's best friend for years and years. And we were always inseparable. And, you know, I just loved my mother. I just wanted to bask in her, in her radiance. Mm. But then when I left that, when I got over that, sort of there went romance in some ways for me.
Mm-hmm. We don't have too much choice in that evolution, do we? Because
I wonder.
Our bodies change, our minds change, and then we meet, you know.
And we see our parents'
others.
Frailties.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do think the love of childhood is the love in childhood is such a sturdy, fierce connection that you have with your friends, that pre-sexual love where you're incredibly loyal and in Mona's book, Hector and Miles are just, they have this bond that's so recognizable to me from my childhood that makes you yearn for that kind of just kind of mischievous, intense, making your own world and living in it and inhabiting it.
Well, they're collaborators.
Yeah.
Which I think you and I have. We're collaborators in a lot of ways. Michelle and I are good friends, and I read this book as Michelle was writing it, and she read my book too. I think actually it's sort of a secret of adult life. I think a lot of people have really intense friendships, often with people with whom they work.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, they have their weekday husband mm-hmm. or wife.
Mm.
You know.
Mm. Your books are also, well, they're both about families in some ways. Obviously in different ways. Can you talk about the love or the love relations that take place in families? I mean, to some extent, one of the registers of love can be great disappointment. It doesn't have to be passionate, you know, exuberant love. It can be profound loss, which can be a form of love, hidden. And I think with Cress, with your character, one can feel her sense of disappointment in her mum and her father. What do you think?
Oh, I think that that's accurate. I think that Cress's parents certainly mean well. They have a cabin in the Southern Sierras, which the mother insists upon the first time her older daughter gets a date or gets a boyfriend when she's 13 or 14. The mother says, that's it. They start camping every weekend. They get this cabin. She is going to protect her kids.
From sex.
From sex, from booze, from drugs.
From fun.
From fun, yes. But also from experience and denies a kind of basic growing up that I think is fundamental that Cress later tries to sort of make up for lost time. But it's a way of, it's so over her children without seeing her children or seeing what her children need. And the father, you know, building this cabin without ever really questioning, is this really what my daughters want and can use? Mm. And there's a problem throughout the book of her not being seen by her parents. So when she's seen by a lover, it's incredibly intoxicating and powerful to her.
Mm. Mm.
Do you want to read that little? You have a beautiful passage about being seen.
Oh, well, that's
and known about being known.
Well, that's about the man being known, but I suppose it's about both people being known.
Well, I'll read actually.
Oh, good. I
have a segue. I have a segue to your passage, which is about love. This is a quote from John Berger, and he says. This is his sort of, well, I guess he doesn't even use the word love, but he says, do we not dream of being known, known by our backs, legs, buttocks, shoulders, elbows, hair, not psychologically recognized, not socially acclaimed, not praised, just nakedly known, mm-hmm. known as a child is by its mother.
Mm.
And so this is Cress deep in her love affair with a man named Quinn. And they've had difficulties, a lot of back and forth. In the dark early morning hours, she woke up to his murmuring. His legs wound around hers. His lips moved against her ear. You're the great pleasure and comfort of my life. For the first time, I've known what it's like to have real company, real attention. Before you, I was always alone. Since that first walk together, I haven't wanted to go even a few hours without hearing your voice. I don't mean anything against Sylvia. She's a good person, an excellent mother, but she never knew me the way you do. She needs so much for herself just to get through every day. I was okay with giving her that for 20-some years, but you showed up, and now I've gotten used to having something for myself. Your hand brushes my shoulder. My whole body surges toward it. You call up something deep. I'm not sure I can survive without you. When you come into the Staghorn, you look around the room, and the second you see me, your eyes change. They mass up with love and humor and sex. God, it kills me every time. Who knew, but I've been waiting my whole life to be seen like that.
That's extraordinary. And I think that, you know, one of the paradoxes of being in love is that, and I mean, Freud said this, Plato before, that in when one falls in love, there is a suspension of one's own individuality. Much as we love ourselves, and perhaps we can come back to self-love, which is a terribly important form of love. But we are rather tired of ourselves. And then when we fall in love, we are inside an illusion that we are one with the other, which is just blissful. Isn't it Goodness. Wonderful to no longer just be oneself? You're in love, and you and the other are the same. Then, however, when there are problems, if you start to lose that love, and this is part of what brings this to mind when you read it, is you're at a loss. My God, how will I survive now? Survive what? You were surviving well beforehand, so why would you have a hard time surviving now? Well, what you're surviving is a terrible loss. But you're also surviving perhaps the most wonderful delusion that we generate as human beings, that we can actually merge with someone else when we're in love. And that's the pain that this woman, Grass, your main character, seems to have almost continuously throughout mm-hmm. this. And she's a smart young woman. She's not unaware of what's going on, but she can't stop herself.
Right, right. It's too tempting.
It's too tempting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But we do talk about blind love, don't we? And there's something we haven't discussed it. We will now talk about it, perhaps. Making love. Because in the act of making love, which is, I don't know how they formulated in other languages. I think it's a curious phrase to use, making love, as in you're like cooking. Like making, why would you make love? I mean, what are you making if you're making love? But when you're making love, you're writing about his legs entwining hers, the very physical, embodied connection between the two of them. There's something wonderful about that intelligence, this body intelligence. Mm-hmm. You're not sitting there thinking about it. And one of the ways to kill it is to sit up and say, let's talk about it, shall we? You know, that's a very powerful kind of connection. As I think Miles's connection to his mother is, it's not what there. It's very hard to word this, Mona, but it's as much what isn't said by you as a writer about that love relationship as what is said. It's what you leave out that's said that's vital, I think, to our sense of that child's passion for his mother.
Maybe.
You don't know because you only wrote it.
I think he's watching a lot of these things. I think, again, he's kind of, I mean, he's watching these things and he's figuring all this out. Mm. He loves his mother, but that's also kind of like, you know, he loves her as a chair, the way we all love our parents. You know, she's there, his father is there, they should be there. That's life. And then his parents separate and things begin to come into more vivid color, if possible, you know, partly because of the terror. And so he's observing all these things. And he's watching each of his parents forge these new lives with other people. And it's both frightening to him. He's both protective. He's looking at his mother's romance in the sense of, will this guy help us? Can he help us financially? Will he? He pays attention to me. I kind of like him. But at the same time, he's thinking, he seems foreign. And will he hurt my mother? And if he's possibly going to hurt my mother, could I protect her? Could I stop it? But he can't, you know, because his mother, like Cress,
she wants it. She wants that beautiful illusion or delusion, whichever we think it is, of love.
But it's interesting. At one point, he explains to his sisters. His sisters have this automatic belief in romantic love, and they're
younger.
They're younger, and they're very worried that his parents, their parents, never had it. Why don't you read that?
Boop One asked me what our parents had been like together. My two sisters sat huddled next to each other, waiting for my answer. I guess you don't remember much. They shook their heads. I pitied them. Were they ever in love? Boop One asked, her round face brave. I rubbed my eyes. Once, our dad told me, that he'd taken her to hear Ella Fitzgerald in her last public concert at Carnegie Hall. They went for drinks after in the Rainbow Room. He'd said that as if I knew what the Rainbow Room was, and I hadn't asked. But now my sister did. I guess kind of a famous place in New York. She nodded, somber, absorbing the information as if it were important. So then what happened? I didn't know how to answer. I mean, whatever happens. And what was love, if not Ella Fitzgerald in Rainbow Rooms? These were our family myths. Was there more to it? Sex, I remembered, the drop in my stomach. But I couldn't say that to the Boops. Well, you know, they got married and came out here. He wanted a different kind of law, and I guess there was that long-shot job for her at UCLA, and then they both got lucky. Before, she'd worked in the New Jersey woods, where an ancient emeritus mathematician had walked across a field to lift her hand, saying, "I heard about the ring." Our dad liked being the man who'd given her the ring. I liked him being that, too, though after the emeritus mathematician, she'd only worn it sometimes. I wondered where that ring was now. One of my sisters should probably eventually get it. Were they really in love? Boop One asked. Because if they were, they would never stop being. Well, yeah, they were, but you know them. I couldn't really handle this. Guys, I felt like saying to my folks, this is your job. The truth was, I couldn't see the two of them together anymore. They once upon a time fit a way they didn't now. He's kind of like going out late at night in Hollywood, and she wanted pictures on the stairway wall, a piano in the living room. The family romance, Eli had called it, you and your family romance. But we have pictures on the wall and a piano, Boop Two wailed. We did, it was true, I'd flubbed up explaining. I mean, they were in love, but we were in the Boop's room on the floor, and I picked up two Rubik's cubes. I held them together so they touched only on the blade of an edge and explained, they connected on a corner. That didn't go over either. Boop Two was right. We did have pictures and a piano. They never went out late in Hollywood. Why hadn't they? That was a bad thing to remember, too. Probably they hadn't because of us.
Now, I wonder how many of us parents would survive our children's recollections of our love relations. They're the most remarkable critics, children, aren't they? But in a sense, also, I suppose when your character, Cress, is being observed by the locals, and in her relations, she comes in for a fair amount of skepticism about her judgment. Is she really in love? Do you know what it is? And these are adults commenting. Here you've got the kids doing a wonderful critique of sort of children's skepticism.
Well, of course, the problem is that Cress is in love with a married man. So that, for some reason, brings her into people are quite ready to criticize her. It's sort of an open field for criticism. And I think that gets questioned more because it's, you know, socially so disapproved of and unsanctioned, and people feel free to tell her, he's just using you to stir up his marriage, or he wants to have his cake and eat it too. People have all these theories, of course, and that run counter to what Cress is actually experiencing, although perhaps they all have a grain of truth.
It's so typical that they would barrage her with that and not him.
Yes, well, men will be men. I mean, that seems to be the sort of... this is in a small Sierran community. I don't mean to make sexist comments, but I would say that that would be one of the...
We knew you didn't mean that.
I didn't mean... It's prevailing attitude. My favorite thing that happens to Cress, though, is that her her lover's sister-in-law belongs to a small prayer group, and Cress gets her name on the prayer list, and they try to pray her out of town.
Yeah. Well, I suppose one of the... hard things to defend about a love relationship or being in love is that it doesn't last in the way we expect it to last. I mean, were it not for the Montagues and the Capulets, Romeo and Juliet would have fallen over something domestic. Like, how can you leave your goddamn cups on the table like that, you jerk? So because they suicide, that romance never ends. But romances, passionate love, the kind to some extent we're talking about, it doesn't last. And then what? And I'm not going to bore the group here with the many different psychological theories of the stages of love. I mean, different psychological groups divide over whether they're 4, 6, 8, or 10. By the time you come to the end of it, you're so depressed. And it's so tedious that you just want to just shut the bloody book and go back to dreaming about falling in love and what that is. But one of the things I wanted to just get to here is that one of the things that falling in love does tend to anesthetize us against is hate. Because love and hate, they do go together. Mm-hmm. And that can be quite a shock to a couple who think they've just been in love, for one of them to say something, did you say that? Did I hear you say that? No, I didn't really mean that. And so it gets deferred. So eventually it's going to change, isn't it? It's going to morph.
Hopefully not into hate.
Well, I'm afraid it...
often does.
I hate to spoil your evening. But hate will rear its ugly head. Yes, it does. Now, it's not necessarily a bummer in the sense that if you can bring it into the bedroom, now we're going to go back to making love, if you can actually bring it into the place of eroticism, as it were, it sort of brings together love and hate in very interesting ways, in ways that are actually rather exciting. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to discuss that any further. You know? I'll leave it up to their imagination. But
I think it's true with both of our characters that they get a lot of warning signals. They are anesthetized. They get a lot of warning signals about their lovers that they overlook because they're so in love. For example, there's a scene where your mother and her boyfriend, the boyfriend has brought a dog into the house, and the little girls, the twins, love the dog and they play with him, and one of them has a terrible allergic reaction. And yet the boyfriend is so concerned about the dog.
He's an animal rights person. He's an animal. Nurse to the poor Eli.
And we readers are sort of like, hey, Irene, notice your boyfriend. He's not paying attention to the right person here, the right creature.
Well, and along with the readers, Miles, my character,
yes,
is all over that.
But she's anesthetized. And then in my book, Quinn says at a certain point, he says to Cress, one day you're going to realize how terrible I've been to you. And she quips, she says, I look forward to that day. But it would be a day that would set her free.
And your characters move on in these books. We won't reveal the plots, but they do move on from where they were.
They do, and here's where Michelle and I maybe differ a little bit.
A little bit.
They move on, but they carry a little bit of it with them. Mm. I mean, they take some of it with them. I mean, I guess I'll just say that.
They take wisdom with them, don't you think? They've learned.
They take wisdom, and I think my lover takes a little more. than wisdom. I think she's mm-hmm. she's actually gotten some things from it mm-hmm. that she keeps.
Mm-hmm. What do you have in mind?
Oh, let me see.
Do you want to lie down?
I think, let's see. I wonder if I can say this without... It's hard to explain, but some of what she got from Eli, that wide smile, a way of turning up a sleeve, wearing skirts and canting her leg, she kept.
Mm.
Every few months, she came home carrying shopping bags, one dress for herself and one for each of my sisters. She, my character is a mathematician, and so she had sort of, there was, the much was made by the kids about how mathematicians were the worst dressed people in the world, and so a little of that was from Eli.
Mm, lovely.
And my character keeps something too, so I'll just...
Mm.
He thought of her all day, he said. He loved to recall her slender fingers and long, strong neck. How happy she was when skiing, her energy, her strength. He had never seen a woman's back as well-muscled. Her soul, that long, dry lake bed, slowly filled, and in all the years afterward, she prized her fingers, neck, and strong back because he had.
And part of what, Mona, you're saying, I think, is that, in a sense, there are no regrets because there's a nourishing aspect to the memories of having been in love. Even
if you don't lose it. You don't.
You don't lose it. Well, in fact, perhaps even slightly differently, perhaps unconsciously we know that it's not necessarily going to last like this, but we will be nourished by the memory of what it once was. I mean, wasn't there a film, Splendor in the Grass? yes, it's Wordsworth.
I would put it differently.
It?
I would say that, you know, it's funny, I brought to this conversation a quote that is from Janet Malcolm. I'll read it. It's Janet Malcolm reading Freud, and it's a very pessimistic quote. But
sounds like him.
Yeah. Well, she says basically, it's her reading of Freud, and it's sort of the most cogent attack on the Platonic ideal of romantic love, I think, is she makes it in her first book called On Psychoanalysis, and she says, the phenomenon of transference, how we all invent each other according to early blueprints, was Freud's most original and radical discovery. The idea of infant sexuality and of the Oedipus complex can be accepted with a good deal more equanimity than the idea that the most precious and inviolate of entities, personal relations, is actually a messy jangle of misapprehensions, at best an uneasy truce between powerful solitary fantasy systems. Even or especially romantic love is fundamentally solitary and has at its core a profound impersonality. The concept of transference at once destroys faith in personal relations and explains why they are tragic. We cannot know each other. We cannot see each other plain. A horrible kind of predestination hovers over each new attachment we form. Only connect, the novelist E.M. Forster proposed. Only we can't. The psychoanalyst knows.
You know, what I think so interesting...
I disagree.
Well, I do, too. And I think what's interesting about the Forrester quote, because I recently went back to read Howard's End. Well, you know, that quote, only connect, is constantly misinterpreted. Because if you look at it, only connect has nothing to do with relationship. What Forrester's talking about is only connect prose with passion.
Mm.
Not relationships.
He's talking about Howard Best, isn't he?
A what?
The main character, Howard Best, in Howard.
Well, the Wilcox families and the Schlegel families, when they're looking at the Wilcoxes, and they're trying to think of a family that's very sort of bourgeois, what's missing within the Wilcoxes, and Forrester says they're basically empty, is they cannot connect language with feeling. That's the only connect. It's not to do with relationships. It's to do with language. It's to do with the passion of language. But I would, with you, like you, I would slightly quarrel with Janet Malcolm's focus on Freud, because in a sense, how could we possibly live these lives without illusion? I mean, this is Hollywood, for God's sakes. I mean, we go into darkened rooms and watch actions happening on the cinema, and we come out crying or we're very moved. Nobody turns the lights on halfway through and says, hey, whoa, wake, look, it's just pretend, walk away. So I think that we do know, I would reckon we do know that when we're falling in love, it is an illusion. It is not the thing in itself. We will return to that solitude that defines human subjectivity, which is partly why I referred about 15 minutes back to self-love. Narcissism has got a very bad name. But narcissism is essential to our survival. We're tending to talk about two people. But loving ourselves is the most, in my view, the single most important love relationship there is. If you don't have that, you're done. You're done. If you have it, you've got the basis to live life and try to get through the rather difficult dimensions of a human existence. And falling in love is wonderful. It is. It's wonderful, even if we know it's not going to last. Even as we know, perhaps it's not going to last. Adolescents are resistant to that, of course, for good reason. But then later on, as we go on, we realize it's not going to last. But gosh, you know, when it's happening, is anyone going to say, hey, you know what, this is a bit silly, isn't it? We're not. We don't do that, do we?
Well, our friends give us hints.
Yes. and Cress's friends do that. I felt so sorry for her in that book. I just thought, you know, what a, how did she pick some of these people? You know, and her sister, I got so pissed off with her sister for being sort of like, not sensitive enough to her.
Well, the sister is a little bit like the father, I think. Just going on her own route, very intent without being able to think about other people involved. But I think that the idea of, what happens with Cress is that she falls so thoroughly in love, she actually loses herself. She gets to where she has no sense of self whatsoever. It's sort of the opposite of self-love. In fact, she goes to put on to buy a T-shirt, and she has to think, will he like it? You know, does he like it? Mm. She can't even tell if it looks good on her. It's all seen through this imaginary scrim of him, which is, you know, part of being in love, but it can get to where I think that it's pathological.
Well, also, aren't you to some extent introducing the problematic of self-love for a woman, that a woman can see herself often through the eyes of a man, which is depersonalizing. So what can get in the way of female self-love is, if you're looking at yourself through the eyes of a man, how can you love yourself?
Well, that was
difficult.
Virginia Woolf was talked a lot about if a novel is about women as an aesthetic object, and how can a woman write a novel? But I think I don't know. I think it's not always that. I mean, falling in love isn't always losing yourself. And I mean, certainly there are aspects of that. But I think the love relationship in this story, at least, though it does give the mother some things that she takes with her. And sometimes that happens. You know, it's not always, everything is a question of fits. And, you know, some things fit for a long time. Certainly the feeling of being in love wouldn't last, but certain connections nourish for a long time and others for a short time, but there we have it.
Shall we see what this lot has to say and what comments and questions you'd like to put to these wonderful writers?
Or to...
No. No, thanks. Who would like to... We've got the microphone there. Just raise your hand or make yourself known.
Hello. I think much is made of, like, love being an illusion just because it's easy in a way, because everything... in a sense, is an illusion, especially as writers. I mean, we see, for instance, like, if you looked at The Sound and the Fury, I mean, Faulkner talked about telling it four times and it never actually being the truth, but the truth being somewhere inside there. And I think, you know, yeah, of course, there's an illusionary element to it, but it's easier to say that because of the pleasure you get from it. But even if you're going into a narcissistic view of loving yourself, there's a ton of delusion in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. There's not just simply delusion, but in our relation to ourself, in our internal conversations, where we think we're talking to ourselves, most of that is actually delusional. We're not really having internal conversations. We think we are, and that's based upon assumed knowledge. Without assumed knowledge, we couldn't think. We couldn't speak. So an awful lot of that is the sort of hubris of the assumption that we've had these extensive conversations with ourselves, after which we then draw conclusions, and we can come to lucid comments about this, that, and or the other thing. It's nonsense. Except in a way, it's unconsciously true, but not consciously so. So it's a, and Faulkner and the stream of consciousness novelists, I think, really were on to that. We're really trying to get something happening that is interstitially between consciousness, but is unconsciously driven, about which we don't know very much. So how much do we really know about ourselves? Let's go back to the question of knowledge. Not a hell of a lot. How much does a psychoanalyst know about a patient? Not much. Mm-hmm. How much do I know about my wife? Not much. No, really, I don't know what she's thinking. So we don't really know much about one another insofar as internal worlds. But that's why novels, I think, are so wonderful, because they allow us this accessional illusion that we can know how somebody really is thinking deeply inside the self. It's so wonderful, isn't it?
That's a very interesting thing, because I think we as novelists all know all of that, and at the same time, we do know about our characters. We do know about our characters deeply. Mm-hmm. So that really plays into the way we tell our stories. I mean, I think that's why novels are so, that's why the form keeps changing, because what we assume as a culture is there, and the way we have to fashion that, both those things have to be in a voice telling a story for you to believe it. It's funny, Garcia Marquez died something like 20 years ago, and the way he just died.
In your mind, he did.
No.
In your illusion, yes.
We know that's not true.
He just died, but not 20 years ago, but even more than that, like 1970, 100 Years of Solitude was published here. And the way he made his voice credible is he would say, instead, he always said that he learned from journalism, and instead of saying there was an elephant flying in a magic carpet in the sky, he would say, six elephants flew over the northwest point at, 20 after 2. And that worked in that time. I mean, everyone read that book, and we all believed it, and we all loved it in that moment. What it takes now is different, because we have to sort of absorb where the culture has gone. And we do all basically believe what you said, but at the same time, we know our characters deeply.
Yeah, I think that, in fact, that novelists have a kind of privileged knowledge of their characters, in a sense that I know, we know much more about our characters than we do about our friends and we do about our mates. We know what they're like in bed. We know what they want to eat. Whatever we decide,
Or it's not even what we decide.
It's not even, it's what's the consistent constellation and patterning that falls together. We can determine it, we can know it. So we might actually know our characters or have the illusion of knowing our characters.
Yes, I took a class with, Faulkner was at UVA when I was there. And when being interviewed about his writings, and I don't think he was being disingenuous, he said, I haven't a clue. I have no idea. Don't ask me about my books. I don't know. And I don't think he was bullshitting. I think he really meant it. But I think what Faulkner, perhaps because he was into a type of stream of consciousness, reckoned that a fair amount of writing is outside of consciousness and you don't know. And the pleasure of it is the surprise of what shows up on the page. You think you know, you do sort of, but then you don't know. But because they're arriving out of your unconscious, there is a deep knowledge here of sorts, but unfortunately, because we can't cheat, it's not conscious.
Right.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Somebody.
Next question right over here.
Thanks for being here. This is fascinating to hear you talk about love and your characters and what you've created. So many of the stories today, both novels, television, films, have love as the driving force. So my question to you is, do you think that a story would be successful today if it did not include love? If yes, why? If not, why not?
Well, you mean romantic love?
But when you look at the George R. R. Martin novels, this Game of Thrones thing, and it's all about these, you know, that there's a sort of underlying driving force of love and power. Well, the Harry Potter novels are about, you know, love and magic. You know, so there are different kinds of love. But if there was in previous generations, there were stories that didn't include love as a driving force. But today, in our society, do you think the story would be successful if there wasn't love included? If yes, why? If not, why not?
Well, love has always been a great fictional engine. The rush to union, you know, to consummation, is just an enormous human drive. And it's fueled, you know, it's what makes Trollope's novels gallop. You know, he discusses alcoholism, mental illness, money, politics, the church. But there are so many love stories to kind of create the momentum. So in popular entertainment, it's still quite possible. But I think I actually felt a little abashed that I was writing just a love story. I thought that they've actually gone quite out of style. Especially because women can do so much more these days. It's not just about who you marry. It used to be that marriage was the sole determinant of a woman's future. That's not true anymore.
So when you read Jane Austen, you're not really reading sort of only will she get the nice guy. You're reading, you know, what will her whole political, socioeconomic possibility be. And we don't quite buy that anymore.
No.
But I don't know. I think there's something in it, though, that, I mean, I think not necessarily, I think you could have a successful novel that doesn't pivot on romantic love. But I think in a way, you almost have to love a world in order to see it deeply enough to write it well. So there's some love in there, you know, underneath it all. It might even be very deeply underneath it. But I think if the writer doesn't love that world, it's probably the wrong thing for him or her to be writing about.
You? Do we have somebody before? We don't want to, I think I see you there. Here we go. Microphone coming. There it is.
Thank you. As you were talking, sir, about not knowing much about your wife or the people, doesn't the writer then take on the role of God, the God who can create from the earth to what the story is, to get making, as who said to the statue of Moses, breathe, goddammit, breathe. Well, that's to me the writer you're talking about, who takes the not knowing much and creates the world.
It should be mentioned that the interlocutor is Dr. Bolus's wife.
My wife's going to speak?
No,
that's
not
your wife?
No, sorry.
I thought that would have been very funny. I thought that was you. I'm sorry.
You've just given me another love relationship. I'll see you afterwards.
I think what you're describing about God, that was certainly true in the time of Tolstoy, you know, and that sort of magisterial narration. I don't think we feel that way anymore.
Yeah, I think we've all been brought to the idea that it's all single consciousnesses, apprehending the world from different angles. And you can't, the beautiful omniscience, you know, that allows you, I mean, I said that we know everything about our characters, and I mean, it's, or we can know or can't know, but do we actually get that great voice of authority and that third person and range over the communities like, you know, we're zooming in from above? That doesn't really work so well anymore. People don't believe it, I don't think.
I have a question for Mona, and I love all of your books, and this one I very much love. Without spoilers, I thought it was really interesting that it was extremely suspenseful and very rare. I thought that the main suspense plot point could have gone either way and have been equally as interesting. And I wondered if you knew what the resolution was going to be from the start without giving away what it actually was.
I should almost say with Michelle and I, with both these books and their endings, we kind of fussed with them together. So it's a question of whether we knew. I think we knew the basic lineaments. I think we did.
Yeah, I think
so. With both books.
I think so.
You wrote a longer ending, but it still sort of ended in the same place.
Yeah, it ended where it ended.
If that makes sense.
Who's next? Last question, please. Thank you.
Well, if you're not playing God, isn't there a sense that you can control these characters, what they do, and what happens to them? And so much of our lives are out of our control. And I think I read frequently for insight into the author's control over the characters. One of my very favorite recent books is Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. And he has such a myriad of characters, some real, some literary. But at the end, he's in a spaceship surveying, I mean, not literally, right, but you have the sense that he's above, and he gives you the resolution of both the real characters and the literary characters. Oh, so I think it's in part control.
I think you can overestimate, as a writer, you can overestimate your control. You know, I'm not sure that you can make your characters do something unless you... I think they are who they are. I mean, I think they have a sort of unity in the sense that, you know, you try and make a character do something, and sometimes it just won't feel right or real to what you've already constructed. What is your sense, Michelle?
It's exactly that. I think that they're almost... I mean, when Faulkner said he didn't know, I understand that because they come... They're not. It's not like they're fully formed and you birth them, but there's an allegiance to a truth about them that you have to pay careful attention to, because if you deviate from you just can't force it. You can't decide that they're going to be something other than what fits into.
It's just like one's children.
They're like a pattern. Yeah, they are. Yes.
You can't control them any more than ultimately. You know, there's a great Henry James quote, you know, we do what we can, we give what we have, the rest is the madness of art.
Look, I want to thank all of you for coming this evening. We're going to close up now. We began with love, we wound up with character, and who's in charge. So it's an interesting transition, isn't it? So many thanks to the library, to you who've come and taken part in this discussion, of course, to these wonderful novelists, to Grace.
And to you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.